Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is retired United States Army Brigadier General and Professor Emeritus of History at West Point, Ty Segel. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write in to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @politicon for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Now, before we get started, a couple really interesting announcements. We have some exciting news. James and I are taking Politics War Room to the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 19th. And also the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta on October 12th, both times with important guests. So you can get tickets at politicon.com/tour. And we can't wait to see you there. And next week on Substack, James and I will have a full package each day from the Democratic Convention. Podcasts, columns, Carville uncensored videos, media critiques, maybe even some gossip. Go to www.politicswarroom.com and click the blue subscribe button and follow the steps. It's going to be quite an adventure. Get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com and tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Beam, and ExpressVPN. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, this is our last podcast before that Democratic convention. Harris Walls are coming to Chicago on a high. Yesterday, the Cook Political Report showed them ahead in 5 of 7 battleground states, even in a sixth. You've been there before. So how important is the convention for the fall election? And what does Kamala Harris want to get out of it? And are there any pitfalls to avoid?
Well, okay, start with the pitfall to avoid is don't be a celebrity-centered convention. And don't be let it be anything close to a celebration of coastal culture. I think that they're aware of that. And I would also recommend a column. I've been wanting to get this guy on the show. I think he's one of the best commentators. He is a New York Times columnist. I think his name is Jamel Bowie. I might be pronouncing his name wrong. That guy is smart, and he's insightful, and he doesn't follow everybody else. So let's talk. The convention is highly important. It's going to drive Trump crazy. I expect that we'll get some, I don't want to call it bump, but I would expect that we'll have some, probably not great, because just how much what's left, some improvement in the polling on, you know, when everybody has the Labor Day start at the gun, but why not? It's fine with me. But remember September. So on the 10th of September is going to be the debate. That's going to be a gigantic event. On the 15th, 16th, 17th, somewhere in there, the Fed is going to meet. They're going to cut rates. Now, whether they cut, we have to ask Roger Altman what he thinks, but it's for sure it's going to be a quarter point. It's going to drive Trump crazy. There's some people that urge him to do a half point. I don't know enough about it to predict anything, but it's pretty clear that there's a consensus there's going to be a rate cut. And don't forget, the 18th of September, remember the 18th of September, which is his sentencing day, where he's got to go there and stand up and get literally bitched out by Judge Marchand and could have some imposition on his liberty. So there's a lot coming fast here. That's my point. The convention is coming, and then when you get through with that, in the debate is going to be gigantuous, because debates have been so elevated by the June 27th debate between Biden and Trump. So that number is going to be off the charts, and Trump is going to show up because he needs it. He can't blow this one up. I mean, if he has any hope, it's got to come with this debate. So we'll get something out of the convention, I think. And then there's a lot more to come. There's a lot of action early here.
Yeah, I think what you want to get out of the convention, we're so polarized now, it's different than it was years ago. I think what you want to get is a little, just a teeny blip, you know, a couple points, but you want to kind of harden your support. You want to have people have a better sense of her, not just like her, say it's better than Biden, but just get a better sense of her. And if they do that and they avoid, as you say, the cultural elitism, I think it can be it could be a successful convention. You're absolutely right about Trump. You know, everything is driving him crazy. But, you know, I also, the more I see J.D. Vance, the more fraudulent he is. Now, this is Trump, too. Bear with me just for a minute, because this is important. They're going to be stressing every day the idea of deporting a million migrants, that'll create new jobs for Americans. That is total, complete, if you'll pardon the expression, bullshit. They say they're pro-family, and of course, this would just separate families. But there have been a number of really good studies on this. If you deport a million migrants, you're going to lose 88,000 American jobs. Why? Because if you get rid of the busboys, you get rid of other migrants at a restaurant, it means that the cook and the manager and others who are Americans, they're going to lose their job. And Chloe East of the University of Colorado has documented this. There's a guy at George Mason, not exactly a left-wing bastion, Mike Clemens, who says when businesses unexpectedly lose a pool of labor talent, they cut back on investments. So this is going to be it won't be, as Trump said, we'll create or these people are taking black jobs. I love Simone Biles saying she's really proud of her black jobs. This is not only a social disaster, it would be an economic disaster, too. J.D. Vance, the more I see him, the more fraudulent he becomes, James.
Well, I'll make 2 points here. First, the wisdom of Winston Churchill, who famously said, the only thing worse than having allies is not having allies. Okay? The worst, having immigrants is hard. Not having immigrants is really, really difficult, almost
right.
Impossible.
Right.
So, and I want to go and say, sometimes conventional, you hear this a lot. People really don't know Harris. She has to define herself in this convention. Conventional wisdom is 100% right. That is a correct observation. It's made again and again. It's kind of a throwaway line. You know, it's what I call a cocktail party line. But, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day. Yep. In this instance, conventional wisdom is right. Now, let me tell you where they're wrong. And you hear this a lot. You hear a lot from this Bill Ackman. That guy, he might be some genius at middling interest rates. He don't know jack shit about politics. And you hear this from the guy. Trump needs to get away from the ad hominem and get to the issue. Okay, fine. What fucking issue you want to talk about? Do you really want to talk about abortion? No, we don't want to talk about that. Do you really want to talk about crime? Oh, crime's down to dropped historic. You really want to talk about the border? You killed the border deal? Border crossings are now lower than it was when he took office? What issue do you really want to talk about? Because you only got two issues. Two. Understand that. And they're powerful. Misogyny and racism. You don't have shit after that. You want to talk about inflation? Good. Look at the numbers today. Tell me about inflation after the Fed cuts interest. This bullshit. If we just get back to the issues. No. You got two issues. Misogyny and racism. I mean, they're pretty powerful. And Trump knows that. And he's not going to give them up because a bunch of fucking people are sitting around saying, we need to get back to the issues. Good. Let's go to them. We're fine with that.
Well, and if Bill Ackman and Donald Trump want to talk about the economy, my wife had a long interview on PBS last night with Jamie Dimon, who said our economy is the envy of the world. We have the best economy maybe in the history of the world. There are problems, to be sure. But for them to say that Biden and Harris have wrecked the economy, it's a hell of a lot better than it was when they were in office, James.
and the crime rate. They keep talking about crime.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? All right. And again, the border, let's talk about the issues. Oh, we better talk about your voters. You pointed out, how are you going to vote in November on the Florida referendum? You still hadn't told us. And you're sitting there running around your stupid mouth about how she hadn't done a long form interview yet. Well, just answer the fucking question and shut up.
Yeah, well, he's James, you're picking on a man who's really in bad shape. I mean, you know, this is he's really unhappy now. He's angry. He's going to lash out. And as you say, next week is going to drive him crazy.
Ooh, yes. He better get his dentures glued back in because it kept falling out during the Elon Musk thing.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, you raised the issue of whether those news organizations should publish the hack material that came, hack material from Trump. Apparently there was hack material from Biden too, that may have been done by the Iranians. There is a certain inconsistency here. If you can publish material in 2016 that was hacked by the Russians on Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, why not this material? I think the whole larger issue is complicated. There's nothing wrong with publishing factual and relevant material, even if the source acquired it illicitly. Pentagon Papers is the best example of that. You know, as far as this one is concerned, I don't know what's in this. They said there's a 271-page vet of J.D. Vance last February. If it just is a rehash of what we know about him, you know, no reason to publish it. If, in another example, a politician, there was a hacked material and you found out that a politician, a national candidate, had engaged in some illegal act, of course you publish it in context. And I would just say, finally, I think you don't publish raw intelligence files. I thought that BuzzFeed and Ben Smith made a huge journalistic mistake in publishing the Steele dossier. I think it was right to cover it, to say there is a dossier out there, there are charges that are made, but to publish raw material, raw intelligence, is wrong. So I'm not sure what I would have done as an editor with this material because I don't know what's in it.
Well, but thank you. I mean, I think your observation, given your lengthy experience in journalism, is valuable, and you know we'll keep monitoring this, and we'll keep talking about it because I think people are interested. Of course, you know, my own view is it's always, you can do it if it's a Clinton, but for nobody else because they operate under a different set of rules. But that's my view. But let's move on from there.
Yeah, well, you're right. But next week, James, we're gonna have a ball at the Democratic Convention because we're going to be talking to lots of interesting people and doing lots of interesting things. So I actually am looking forward to it.
Oh, I'm terrific. I'm looking forward to it, too, and see people. And we got a big Clinton reunion. I think it's on Monday, so I'm really excited about that. And, I think I'm going to operate from the Four Seasons most of the whole time. I'm much interested.
Well, I'm riding your coattails because we're going to be doing our Substack podcast and everything. But, you know, when you're at the Four Seasons, James, I don't mind riding your coattails.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's not a bad place. I love that. That Four Seasons Chicago on Delaware Avenue is one of my favorite hotels in the whole freaking world, I'll be honest with you.
Okay, I hope all of you out there will tune in.
Tune in. We're going to have fun. Beat the heat with Miracle Sheets. I want to make a point about this product. I estimate that at night, you can put your thermostat 3 degrees warmer if you use this than you normally would. Now, you think of your energy cost savings about running your air conditioning system at 3 degrees above where you would normally run it, and this thing will pay for itself in a week. This is actually a investment. It'll save a ton of money, but it's going to be some. It's going to be some, I promise you.
You know, sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day. Now, if you wake up too hot or too cold, we highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Miracle Made sheets are inspired
by NASA and use silver-infused thermoregulating fabrics. So you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long, no matter what the weather is like outside. Plus, the silver lining prevents 99.7% of bacterial growth, which means Miracle Sheets require three times less laundry because they stay clean and fresh three times longer. Your bed will feel freshly made every night. So stop sleeping on bacteria that can clog your pores and cause breakouts and acne. Sleep clean with Miracle instead. Now, trust us, with no more gross odors, life's a whole lot better for your household. The NASA-inspired temperature-regulating silver-infused fabrics truly give you maximum comfort in any weather, and they make pillowcases and comforters, too. So join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle Sheets luxuriously comfortable, they don't have the high price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle Sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some five-star hotels. So it's a vacation every time you get into bed. I usually picture myself in Bermuda. I don't know, James, someplace like that. Go to trymiracle.com/war room to try Miracle-made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo, War Room, at checkout, you'll get three free towels and save an extra 20%. Now, Miracle's so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/war room and use the code War Room to claim your free three-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/war room to treat yourself. So thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. And look for the link in our show notes. Our guest, James, is an old friend, retired Brigadier General Ty Segel, also the former chair of the History Department at West Point, and he was the Joshua Chamberlain Chair of History at Hamilton College. General, it's so good to have you with us. J.D. Vance and the Trump campaign are disparaging the Democratic vice presidential nominees, Tim Walz's 24-year service and departure from the National Guard. You've read about this. Is this legitimate or just political demagoguery?
It's political BS. It's terrible. This guy served 24 years. And so, 1% of Americans ever are serving their nation. And 1% of those who ever raise their right hand and enlist get to be a sergeant major. He was a command sergeant major of a battalion. His service was extraordinary, represents the National Guard. He's a senior enlisted person to ever serve in the United States Congress. We're lucky to have him on a ticket, and I think he's making a great team with Kamala Harris. So, no, what Vance is doing is wrong.
Well, and I think if you look, I mean, the charge is that he left the Guard as it was about to be deployed. Fact of the matter is, he resigned from the Guard almost a year before it was deployed because he was running for Congress after 24 years. And the other misrepresentation, they talk about stolen valor. He said that he achieved a certain rank, which he did.
And, he totally did.
And it was totally it was different when he left. It's really kind of appalling.
It is appalling. And I don't know what it is that means that somebody who served in a uniform of the nation, who served for 24 years, gets to be disparaged like that. Remember, he re-upped. He hit his 20 years when 9/11 happened the same week, and he decided to re-enlist. And then was sent to Vicenza when his daughter was 2 years old, leaving his wife behind. We got to remember that Gwen also served the nation as a family member and went over there and did the mission that the U.S. Army and the nation asked him to do and then came back. And I think it's also important to remember that he served the battalion, the 1st of the 125th Field Artillery, faithful, is their motto, so well in the Minnesota National Guard, and then went into Congress, though, and was an amazing representative for veterans and the military and helped get through the new GI Bill and made sure that the VA was taking care of blast victims from IEDs. I mean, he really served the nation incredibly well as a congressman as well, too.
Nancy Pelosi told me she didn't know of any other member while she was
was in Congress who did more for veterans than Tim Walz, often working with a Texan named Chet Edwards. I think this is really unbecoming of J.D. Vance, who also served honorably in the United States Absolutely. Marine Corps. But I think it takes something from him when he engages in this, particularly when he's doing it on behalf of someone who got out of Vietnam because the family doctor said he had bone spurs, which suddenly disappeared, and said that his Vietnam was avoiding venereal disease. I mean, really, J.D. Vance, you should not be talking about this.
Yeah, I think that it is. I don't think I've ever known an American politician who has contempt for those who serve like Trump does. I mean, it goes, there's so many of them. Well, for John Kelly, who was standing in Section 60 of Arlington at the grave of his son, Robert Kelly, who died in 2010 in Afghanistan, and turns to his father, his chief of staff, retired four-star John Kelly, and says, I just don't get it. Like they're suckers to have done this. And he has since confirmed that this is the truth, that he said that while he was at Arlington National Cemetery. And he did the same thing to the Gold Star family, the Khans, and he did the same thing to John McCain, of saying that his service, because he was shot down in Vietnam, somehow was less. But he just doesn't get what it means to serve the nation.
No, he sure doesn't. James Carville?
So, General, walk us through this, because, of course, the highest ranking enlisted person ever served in the United States Congress is quite distinguished. There was this thing that he was an E-8 and he was promoted to command sergeant major, but there was a course that he had to complete. So
right.
What is his actual rank, an E-9 or an E-8? What did he give us the
He was an E-9, a command sergeant major right. in that position. He was a command sergeant major in the role of command sergeant major. To retire in a rank requires two things. It requires 3 years in grade, and it requires attending whatever the schooling that happens. And for an enlisted soldier, particularly one in the Guard or Reserve, it usually means box of books, which means that you don't go to the course. Some of them do get a chance to do that. Others just get this linear feat of boxes that they have to go through online, either online or in boxes, and complete. It's an incredibly onerous task and doesn't really help much, frankly, if you ask me, unless you go to the course that's in San Antonio, the Command Sergeant Major course. So he didn't do those and chose to retire. So he reverted back to his E-8. But he was a command sergeant major. He was the command sergeant major of the 1st of the 125th. And most people that don't serve don't realize, and James, maybe you remember do you remember the sergeant major in your
No,
unit?
God, he was a god. I was around that guy. I would be more intimidated by a sergeant major than a major, maybe.
Totally. This second lieutenant. Yeah. First lieutenant was way more intimidated by a command sergeant major than a major.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the right hand of God. And in fact, in most cases, if the sergeant major called you into his office, I don't care if you're a corporal or a captain, you're going to be shaken in your boots more than if the battalion commander called you.
The Marine Corps was called sergeant major. It was the Army did that too. It's a kind of slang.
Sergeant major. Hey, Sergeant, and listen, there's a rank, the way the rank looks. So when you look at that, it's three rockers above, three chevrons above, three rockers below, and inside there's a star and then a wreath around that for the command sergeant major, which means, and they're command sergeant majors from battalion all the way up to, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So this is a huge position, and one that is given to only the most, again, 1% of those who ever raise their right hand ever get to that position. So it's an incredible honor.
So it's not an on-the-line call if he says that I was a command sergeant major. That's not a close call. That's a fact.
It's not a close call. Now, if he puts something in there, says, in my retirement rank, but if he says I served as a command sergeant major, it's totally true. And by the way, 24 years wearing the uniform, and during that time, he did the things that the Guard does. It's a chance for us to talk about the importance of the Guard. He went and put out fires at Yellowstone. He did tornado recovery operations. He went up to the Red River in northern Minnesota in Grand Forks during those huge floods in 1999. He was a military technician, which means as a young enlisted soldier, he was the guy in charge of the guard in a civilian job. He's been a guards member in Texas, in Arkansas, in Nebraska, and also in Minnesota. He raised his right hand 2 days after he turned 17. This is a guy who has done nothing but serve this country and serve this nation and serve the state for his entire career. And it shows. He knows what it means to serve.
Wow. I mean, it's so, turn it right back to Al, and we'll talk a little bit longer. Do you expect to see a more than usual number of retired flag officers come forward and talk about how important this election is to the armed forces?
Well, I think we've seen that on both sides. They've been going, really, this goes back. When was the first one, James? You remember the first one, don't you? When Crow and some others did this. I don't know, it was in the 90s, wasn't it?
92, yeah, Admiral Crow. He came to Little Rock, yes. We were very solicitous of that.
Absolutely. I think you really started that with Crow. It really did. And it's been grown since then. I think what you end up seeing is that on the Republican side, they have at the most a one-star, maybe a three-star, and not many, and lots of retired colonels and lieutenant colonels. I think you'll see on the Democratic side more senior-ranking ones, particularly with what he said to retired military. I mean, you know, this is a guy that Trump said to Mark Milley that he should be charged for treason and executed. Yeah. Remember that. I mean, you just go back and the contempt he's shown for those in uniform has just been outrageous.
So I just want to make one point, turn it back down. Look up the Wikipedia on General Milley. I think he's got some fruit salad on his chest.
This guy served, again, all these guys, and remember, Trump is also the one that when one, I don't remember who it was, went down to Mar-a-Lago to interview for one of the jobs they had, or he was down there briefing, and went to turn to one of the jobs. So, hey, General, how much do you make? He said, do you make what? Five? This is Trump saying to a general, do you make like $5 million a year? And the guy said, no, sir. You know, my pay is capped at about $190,000, not including my housing. And I was like, well, what? Why do you do this then? And so that just does not understand the reason why those of us who have served choose to serve. And it's something greater than yourselves. And, you know, I keep my flag right behind me because people tell me because I go after Confederates or whoever I'm criticizing, somehow you don't love your country if you criticize either the president or other people. And they're patriots who serve in the uniform of all different political persuasions. And I think we'd be good to remember that. And that patriotism isn't just controlled by one side of the aisle.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that. I have enormous admiration for the former Defense Secretary General James Mattis. And he has said, you know, he thinks that Trump would be a danger to our national security. But he has told people that ex-Marines officers really shouldn't get involved in politics. I don't think there's a more decorated former Marine commandant than David Shoup, who was the most outspoken critic of the Vietnam War and Lyndon Johnson. And there were others. I would hope General Mattis would have a second consideration because the stakes are so huge. I think they transcend any tradition that he honors.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting one. We grow up in the military being apolitical. In fact, I know many officers who never voted because they thought this is the example of George Marshall, who mm-hmm. said, I will never vote in an election. And so you have to be very, of course, you're not allowed to do any of this in uniform. And we used to give talks at the military academy, particularly our civilians, about the Hatch Act, you know, and how careful you have to be about this. So it's in our DNA not to talk about things politically. And I'm not, I've never joined a political party. I consider myself nonpartisan. It doesn't mean I don't vote. It doesn't mean that I don't look at one of these candidates as being unqualified. But I do think that within the military sphere, that general officers are very wary of coming out and doing this. I think it's less so now than it was previously. But I do think that people are always a little bit wary of using their uniform to do that, because we do want to make sure that the American people trust the military. And we remember after the Vietnam War, when you know that the military was at the nadir and no one trusted or believed in or wanted to wear the uniform. And so we want to make sure that we are as broadly representative of the American people as possible.
Well, I think that's an important distinction. I can see how people feel that way if it were Bob Dole against Bill Clinton or whatever. The difference this time is that most of these people, and I'm sure General Mattis feels this way, really believes that Donald Trump, an elected Donald Trump for the second time, would be a serious threat to America's national security. It seems to me that should transcend whatever tradition they grew up in.
Well, I do think, you know, one of the things that many of the forward, at least this military, former military officer thinks is that we have, our strategy since World War II has been forward collective defense. And that means that we will be out there with our allies, creating allies to ensure that war doesn't come to us. And it has been extraordinarily successful, this forward collective defense, particularly with NATO. It's the longest period of peace in European history. And when there wasn't peace in the Balkans, America came in and brought peace back. And so I think the idea that we would go away from this forward collective defense and go away from NATO is a disastrous policy. So anybody that thinks that, and J.D. Vance has been forward and foremost among those of saying isolationism. And I think these isms all come together with J.D. Vance, which is nativism, isolationism, and protectionism all come together. And in fact, it's reminiscent in a way of the 1920s when these things all came together under these isms. And I got to tell you, whether it's Smoot-Hawley tariffs, whether it's the Washington Conference and the isolationism, and then the nativist policies on immigration policy all came together. And what the outcome with the Great Depression and World War II, not good. So I think we've got to be very wary of anybody who thinks that isolationism is going to work for the American people.
James.
So General, I want to ask you about this a little bit different, but I'm just sure you following the events in Ukraine and this offensive incursion into Russia, into the Kursk area. Of course, in a military historian, the word Kursk has ramifications beyond anything we can imagine. But are you encouraged by this? Do you think it's something real and really kind of clever that they pulled off here?
I do. Yeah. So I think, you know, I was thinking about this, and I think that there are a couple of reasons why they did it. And I think, one, it gains the initiative. And in war, you know, you've got to have the initiative. You can't just be on the defense the entire time. So they're gaining the initiative and forcing the attack. That counterattack they tried last time into the teeth at the Donbass didn't work. So here it is. They can do that. Two, they can humiliate Putin. And I tell you, that's a good day any day that you can humiliate that war criminal. And it is, because it's showing he can't protect the Russian people. It's making forces from the Donbass redeploy to Kursk, which is going to help that part in the eastern part of Ukraine. It's going to confuse the Russians. What comes next? Ukraine could attack in many places. No Russian is safe. And it makes Ukraine seem different here in the West, that we look at them and go, oh, look at that. They can do that. And from his former armor officer, it also shows that combined arms, artillery, tanks, air, and infantry working together can still have surprise and effectiveness on the battlefield.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Albert.
And I'll tell you, so what's next? So let me give you what could come next in the Ukraine. I think there are three possibilities. The first possibility is they continue to expand and hold the territory and fortify it and make Russia come to get them. There's a disadvantage there, and it is that they have exposed flanks, which will make it easier for the Russians when they get there finally to attack them at their own place and makes them sort of vulnerable to counterattack. The second course of action they could do is to sort of fall back to defensible positions in Russia, which makes it harder for the Russians to attack them, but still makes it's still possible that they could find a flank and do that. So I think that's the second. But they could then hold territory and then make that some sort of exchange. Risky, but possible. I think the likeliest possibility is that they will fall back into Ukraine, use this as sort of a big raid and just thumb their nose and say, listen, we can do this anytime we want, and force Russia to now put more forces all across their border as a reminder that, hey, listen, we're going to do this whenever we want. And that will force the Russians to deploy forces elsewhere. So I think that's what they'll do. But, you know, they've been surprising so far. We'll see what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Albert, go ahead.
Anything? No, they have. Listen, you have made everything we've talked about today has been interesting, informative, and important. You are a great guest. I'm so glad that you clarified everything on this smear campaign against vice presidential nominee Walz and his honorable service. And it's just so good to have you on the show. And we hope you'll come back, General.
And everybody,
and you know, the Marine down there, we've been going at it. The soldier and the Marine been going at it a little bit lately. Two great services.
So I'd recommend our listeners look at something that General Ty likes, and I love it too. It's called the Duffel Bag. And it's a kind of soldier's humor spot. And the brass kind of likes that. And it's pretty funny. I mean, it's a military version of The Onion. And a lot of people it's just not that, it's not the way it used to be. But you can learn a lot through humor. And I think The Duffel Bag is one of the great publications in the United States right now of any kind.
Yeah, I've been sending James a couple of the greatest hits there. And my son and I, who served for 4 years in the 1st Cavalry Division, you know, we send these things back and forth all the time because there is humor. I mean, to serve, James, how much most of the time of being a soldier or a Marine is just making fun of what you have to do. So people in the military, you gain a sense of humor or you get out real quick.
Yeah, or you have a miserable time. Thank you so much, General.
Thank you.
Okay. Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
Get the sleep you deserve with Beam Dream. Oh, man. You know, like I've said on this show any number of times that I mean this, how you feel the next day is largely determined how you slept at night. And I like our sponsors because they understand that, and we all understand this, and this is an invaluable part of your sleep toolkit. I like to throw a lot of different things at it, the right sleep, the right food. For God's sakes, there's nothing better than when I get up and I look at my watch and it's like 7 o'clock in the morning. I go, hallelujah.
You know, you're right, because sleep is the foundation of our mental and physical health. When you sleep well, you can perform at your best, mentally and physically. Proper sleep can also increase focus, boost energy, and improve your mood. Introducing Beam's Dream Powder, a science-backed, healthy hot cocoa for sleep. Dream has been a game changer for so many. Politics can be stressful, and it was horrible watching the hours tick until the alarm went off. Now we know all it takes is one delicious cup of Beam before bed, and I'll be sleeping great. You'll be sleeping great, ready for the day ahead. Today, our listeners get a special discount on Beam's Dream Powder. They're science-backed, healthy, hot cocoa for sleep with no added sugar. Better sleep has never tasted better. There are tons of delicious flavors like chocolate peanut butter, cinnamon cocoa, and sea salt caramel. But they're only 15 calories with 0 grams of sugar. You know, you can't get enough of chocolate peanut butter. That's so great. It's always a treat. And now, wanting better sleep no longer keeps us up at night. Other sleep aids can cause next day grogginess, but Dream contains a powerful, all-natural blend of reishi extract, magnesium, theanine, melatonin, and nano-CBD to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. Dream works fast, and the numbers don't lie. In a clinical study, 93% of participants reported Dream helped them get better sleep. Those odds are pretty good, James.
I like them. I like them a lot. And let me tell you, I cannot tell you how determinative you feel. It's just where you sleep the night before. And this is a big, valuable part of your toolkit.
Yeah, it sure is. Beam Dream is easy to add to your nighttime routine. You just mix Dream in the hot water or milk, froth, and enjoy before bed. You'll find out why Forbes and the New York Times are all talking about Beam and why it's trusted by the world's top athletes and business professionals. Now, if you want to try Beam's best-selling Dream Powder and get up to 40% off for a limited time, go to shopbeam.com/war room and use the code war room at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/war room and use the code war room for up to 40% off. You also can find the link in our show notes. Hey, James, we have our next guest is Morgan Jackson, who probably knows more about North Carolina politics than any person alive. He's been a chief aide to Governor Roy Cooper, an advisor to the Attorney General, gubernatorial candidate Josh Stein. And if you want to talk about North Carolina politics, the place to go is Morgan Jackson. Morgan, the last couple elections, presidential elections, the last three have not gone well for the Democrats. They have been winning state elections, but doing poorly in presidential elections. There's some indication it may turn around. I saw the Cook Political Report had a poll out today. I don't know how good it is, but it had a poll out saying that actually Harris is ahead in North Carolina. Are you feeling better about your state?
I'm feeling very optimistic, Al, about our state. As you know, it was the closest election in 2020 that Biden lost. Right. I always like to remind folks when you're thinking about North Carolina, you have to also understand that in 2020, Republicans had the best electoral environment that they've had in modern times. And what I mean by that, Al, is 81% of Republicans turned out to vote in 2020, 75% of white voters. You had the largest Republican, the largest white, the largest rural, ex-urban turnout in North Carolina history. And even with that math, even with a more favorable environment for Republicans, Trump did 2.5 points worse in North Carolina in 20 than he did in 16. And so North Carolina is a place largely because of our growth in the metro areas in Raleigh and Charlotte that is getting more Democratic, more progressive. And I don't mean liberal, but I mean progressive in how people think about issues. And
Roy Cooper type progressive.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Roy Cooper type progressive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Roy Cooper type progressive. And what we're seeing is that the huge growth and influx of these urban areas, not only are Democrats every year getting a larger margin of victory in counties like Mecklenburg and Wake and Durham and others, we're actually winning a larger piece of a bigger pie. And so, you know, transformation is taking place. The urbanization is taking place in North Carolina. What happens is the reason we're such a 50-50 state is, to quote Carville, we're sort of like Pennsylvania. It is, we are Virginia. What half of the state is, 50% of the state is like Virginia, and 50% of it's like Alabama. And right now, those two sort of competing factions. We have the second largest rural population in the country outside of Texas. And those competing factions right now make up 50-50. And that's one of the reasons these elections are so close.
Morgan, your black population isn't as large as Georgia, but it's still significant. And the question earlier was, will those voters turn out? Does Harris change that calculation?
I think she does. Listen, I think it's been unprecedented. And what we're seeing in North Carolina in the last 3-4 weeks or less, it feels like 2 years in July. But what we're seeing is unprecedented enthusiasm that, frankly, guys, I haven't seen since 2008 in North Carolina, not just with African-American voters, but with young voters in particular, with younger women, especially suburban younger women that are very excited about it. Harris has been like an adrenaline shot straight into the heart of the Democratic Party in North Carolina. We've seen, you know, they've got 12,000 new volunteers that signed up after Kamala Harris in North Carolina, after Kamala Harris became the nominee. And these are folks that are active Democrats that were just had not signed up to volunteer yet in the last 2 years. And listen, Biden had a lot of volunteers. My point is not that he was suffering from it. It's that Harris has injected 90% of the folks who've signed up had not been engaged in the campaign before. And that's a big deal. That's a lot. They're running shifts, man. You're talking about 2,000 people a weekend in July, in August, in 100-degree weather that are knocking on doors because they're so excited. And these are new people to the process. A lot of folks, you know, they were voting, but now they're giving money. They're knocking on doors. They want to do real things. And that's one of the reasons you see Harris coming here so much. She's been here 8 times this year. And, you know, it's coming back Friday for a major economic speech.
Morgan, I wrote a column some months ago, I suspect guided by you, that it could be this year. It's one of the rare cases of reverse coattails in the sense that you have the Republican candidate for governor running against your attorney general is one of the nuttiest candidates I have ever seen, Mark Robinson. I mean, he's lieutenant governor. He said things that are unbelievable. And your candidate for whatever it is, public instruction, higher education, maybe even nuttier. Do you think there could be some reverse coattails here that they so turn off Republicans, they make it harder even for the top of the ticket?
I do. Listen, I think Mark Robinson, Michelle Morrow, Dan Bishop for AG, Hal Weatherman for lieutenant governor, they have what we have seen out of the Republican primary that took place earlier this year is that, first and foremost, if there was any question, the party of Bush and Reagan is dead in North Carolina. What they have put forward on all the top races are total abortion banners, are election deniers, and people who are conspiracy theorists. And that's not where real people are. And I always like to say that what the Republican Party has done in North Carolina with this election is hitched themselves to the crazy train and driving it off the cliff. I mean, listen, I'll just be honest, and, you know, Al and James, it's a lot of these Republicans that they have nominated, they're like crazy as shithouse rats, man. They're just insane. And you look at Mark Robinson's views on women, it's not just about abortion ban, but his views on women, his disrespect for women in general. Michelle Morrow, the superintendent candidate, Al, you just talked about, has called for the public execution of Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Roy Cooper. And, you know, just a video came out just this week showing her after the insurrection, posting a video of encouraging Donald Trump to call in the military to stop the certification. I mean, that's just insane. That's not where real people are.
Yeah. I'm going to turn it over to James in a minute. One question. How important is the attorney general after the election? And I know a new one wouldn't take office, I assume, until January. But you know Trump, if he loses North Carolina by 50,000 votes, he's going to contest it. He's going to claim he was cheated. How does the process work down there?
So the State Board of Election goes through a certification process, and the State Board has run incredibly smart and thoughtful elections and has done it in a way. And, you know, Al, we're no stranger to tight races. And, you know, James and I were talking on election night in 16, and Cooper won by 10,000 votes 3 weeks later. Right. I mean, we know what the process is. We know what these guys are prepared for. We know that the Trump crowd and the Robinson crowd are going to scream bloody murder. And Trump's been clear that if he doesn't win these states, there's fraud. And so we know they're going to come at it, but we're going to be prepared. We're going to win these elections and be prepared to make sure that we hold them after the election.
James.
So, Mark, let's talk about Alabama, the Alabama part. North Carolina's second in broad number of rural residents. I think they're second or third in percent rural. I think Maine is the most rural state in the country, but North Carolina's right up there with them.
Yeah, that's right.
So do we have anything going? Are we trying something to cut our margins in these really kind of Trumpy, mostly white rural counties? Are we having any kind of thing we're doing to do that to maybe not lose as bad?
Yeah, James, we're spending a lot of time in rural North Carolina. Josh Stein is spending a lot of time in rural North Carolina. As you and I know, both from rural areas, is ultimately are spending a lot of time in rural areas as well. Showing up is what Democrats, first and foremost, you got to do in rural North Carolina and rural America. You got to show up. You got to talk to people about issues that are concerning them. I think one of the things that happened to us in 2020, largely because of COVID, is Democrats couldn't do that. They weren't out there in the communities. And what you see by that is rural voters need to see you. They need to hear you talking about things like public education, community college access for kids to get a trade, to learn different things and understand. And one of the things Josh talks about a lot, and I think connects very well with rural voters, is two things. First of all, it's education. It's about the fact that not everybody is headed to college. And we, as a party, need to talk more about that and offer pathways and invest in pathways for kids to get a good job. If college is not in their, not in their future, or four-year university degree, that is. And the other thing is, it's crime, okay? One of the reasons attorney general candidates make such good gubernatorial candidates is because they've spent their careers working on crime, to reduce violent crime. Josh Stein has, the things he's done as attorney general are pretty incredible. Not only has he eliminated the rape kit backlog that's led to hundreds of new convictions for rape victims, but he's a guy who's focused on how do you combat the opioid addiction, how do you combat fentanyl, things that are really, really hurting rural North Carolina. And so Josh spends a lot of time talking about those issues in rural communities, and I think that's part of it. On the raw politics of it, listen, our challenge has been that one of the reasons that we, even with the growth, we remain a 50-50 state is Democrats do worse every cycle in rural North Carolina, places we used to get 44% of the vote. Over the years, we've gone to 42, 41, 36, 25. And I think our strategy is the way you win is it's not by, you don't have to do a ton better in rural North Carolina, but what you have to do is you have to stop losing by more. And if we hold that line, if we get our 2020 numbers in rural North Carolina, we're going to win these races. And Kamala Harris is going to be president because she's going to have won North Carolina. And that's really the challenge for us, is to make sure we're out there talking to rural voters about issues. And I, certainly from the Stein campaign, he is doing it.
So, Morgan, this is something, that, and it's really true in North Carolina, and I suspect it's true in a lot of other places. You had your volunteers, you had your party structure was prepared for one thing, and then all of a sudden, there's this huge influx. You said 90% first time. Are you confident that the party, the state party organization can like process these people and give them something meaningful to do, can, you know, get them in and then say, hey, let's phone bank this or walk this or show up here, or ever you're going to deploy these new troops you have?
So we've got the largest infrastructure from the Harris campaign on the ground that we've had since 2008. They got 170 staff on the ground right now, 20 offices, 24 offices, I think, by the end of the next couple of weeks. And those are all across the state, not just in Raleigh and Charlotte and Durham, but they're in rural areas as well. And I think they're well positioned. The Harris campaign is very clear. They want to win here, and they're going to do what it takes to win here. And that includes resources and making sure people are utilized the right way. But the party is fired up again. The enthusiasm, I just hadn't seen this kind of enthusiasm on the ground since 08. And we didn't have it in 12, we didn't have it in 16, we didn't have it in 20 like this. It's just off the charts. And it's not just, I'll tell you, when you think about the enthusiasm for the presidential campaign, you've got a lot of candidates that in the last 3 weeks have had some of their best fundraising weeks of the entire campaign that are not the presidential, that are down ballot race. You got a several down ballot candidates who raised $100,000 or more online the day after Harris became the or got into the race. And so you got these volunteers that are enthusiastic that are just, it's like an awakening. It is like the body got out of the casket and folks are excited, man. It's incredible.
Well, Morgan, I can't thank you enough. I know I texted you on short notice, but this was a very valuable segment, and I think it's very valuable to our listeners that they see this. And I'll say this right now, if you can, shoot a check to the Democratic Party of North Carolina. I can assure you they can put it to good use, and I can assure you with Morgan kind of running the show, it's going to be judiciously and strategically well spent. So thank you very much, my friend.
James, let me ask just one more. You know, when you lost that Supreme Court, the Republicans, of course, immediately moved and engaged in one of the most partisan gerrymandering I've ever seen of House seats. Are you dead? I mean, do you have any chance to win more than more than four House seats this November?
No, we do. We have a real shot to break the supermajority. The House is looking really primed to do that. And part of it is think about where, and the Senate has a good option as well. But the House, and now just think about this, the top targeted races that you need to win in order to break the supermajority in the General Assembly, in the House and the Senate, are largely in urban, suburban North Carolina. You know, you've got two House seats in Wake, two in Mecklenburg, that you have to win. The same, you got two Senate seats in Wake and one in Mecklenburg. And what I'll tell you is it's the same voters we're talking about, the enthusiastic, that live in these districts. The super, their majorities that they have gerrymandered are based on what they've done in rural North Carolina. But their super majorities are on the backs of suburban voters that are getting more Democratic. And that's why I'm optimistic and bullish that we can break these supermajorities this cycle, because that's going to be key, because it will keep Josh Stein as governor, being able to sustain vetoes and really put a curb, and as you saw Governor Cooper's done for many of his 8 years, to curb the General Assembly's worst impulses. And, you know, listen, that crowd, we talked about the primaries. The General Assembly's not getting, as they get, they're not getting less conservative. They're actually getting more conservative, because several, even arch conservatives, lost their primaries to really crazy people. And those are who are going to be showing. So the supermajority is a real key. The Supreme Court's a real key. We got one seat up, Allison Riggs, that we have to defend, who's an incredible jurist. And that's the first step in our path to retaking the Supreme Court.
Well, I hope you succeed, because it is such a great state, and you know how much I love North Carolina.
So, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Now, I think this is very valuable for our listeners to hear what's going on, because they get the facts on the ground. Yvette, thank you, man.
Listen, guys, I appreciate you both.
Protect yourself online with ExpressVPN. You know, it's not just, you don't have to be the presidential campaign for these people to be hacking into you. It could be anybody. And it's invaluable to have this kind of protection. And why wouldn't you have it? I mean, it really, you know, you should have it.
Yeah, because going online without ExpressVPN is like putting all your passwords and credit card numbers on a huge billboard for the world to see. Each time you connect to an unencrypted network in cafes, hotels, airports, and other places, your online data is not secure from hackers. Those networks give them easy access to your personal data, like passwords, bank logins, credit card details, so they can steal them for a profit, blackmail, or worse. It's not even a challenge for them. All it takes is some cheap hardware, and even computer-savvy kids can pull off a heist. Worse, it's easy money. Hackers make up to $1,000 per person selling personal info on the dark web. Fortunately, ExpressVPN stops them by protecting you with top-level encryption. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, so they can't get your data, and you stay secure. Amazingly, it would take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past the security ExpressVPN offers. It's super easy to use, too. You know, we had no problems firing it up right away. All you need to do is open the app and click one button to get protected. Even better, ExpressVPN works on all your devices, including phones, laptops, tablets, and more, so you can stay private and protected on the go. So we're so thankful to have ExpressVPN when we're on the road. James and I spent a lifetime working out of hotels, strange offices, and other businesses. And now all it takes is one click to keep them away. Whether it's research, accessing important accounts, or handling sensitive information, we feel so much better knowing our data is protected. We've gotten our families used to it too, and it's great knowing your kids and my 6.5-year-old grandchild, I think now needs it, James, that they're protected too. We know you're going to feel the same way. So secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/warroom. That's ExpressVPN.com/warroom, and you can get an extra 3 months free. Again, expressvpn.com Facebook.com/war room. Now, you also can find the link to start protecting yourself online in our show notes. All right, now for the outrage of the week. Elon Musk is such an outrage, James. I mean, the multi-billionaire bought Twitter, which is now valued at less than a third of what he paid for it. But it wasn't about business for Musk. It's about propaganda, the kind of propaganda you usually see in authoritarian dictatorships. He interviewed on Twitter, or X, I guess it's called, Donald Trump. It was an embarrassing joke. The high point was the communications breakdown in the beginning. But thanks to our friend Judd Legum, we know in recent months Musk himself has propagated over 170 posts on Trump or smears in the Democrats. Let me give you a couple examples. He repeats the charge about Governor Walz, Tim Walz, that, quote, tampon Tim put tampons in boys' bathrooms, end quote. The truth is that Minnesota requires schools to develop plans so that students who menstruate have access to free tampons and pads, which some low-income students do not. Similar programs, in fact, exist in a majority of American states. He also made fun of a video in which Kamala Harris told the audience her pronouns were she and her, and she was a woman sitting at the table wearing a blue suit. Musk loved to mock that. What he didn't note was this comment was in an audience that was commemorating the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it was an accommodation for blind or visually impaired people who were there. No, but Musk's guy Trump, of course, loves to make fun of people with disabilities. You know, and when it comes to disabilities, Elon Musk has one. It's called character.
By the way, of the states that required his, among them is that bastion of progressivism, of coastal liberalism. They call it the People's Republic of Utah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Utah. All right. I mean, it's something wrong with these people. I can't escape from believing that there's something that is fundamentally that they're missing a chromosome or a gene or something like that. Because I never want to say somebody's not human because that's so Nazi and everything, but there's something missing here. This is just not right. So this is more an observation than an outrage. And I think one of the worst policy ideas I've heard came out of Donald Trump's mouth in Nevada, and Harris echoed it. And I probably would have done the same thing. The idea that we would exempt tips from income tax is just horrific public policy. As our dear friend William Woodson points out, but what about the dishwasher? What about the busboy? What about everybody else that works in a restaurant? What about people that work in a hospice? What about maybe E4s in the infantry? I mean, what about firemen? I mean, once you start exempting some people from the income tax, you are going down a policy road that has just unbelievable negative consequences. Now, I understand that Harris had to say it. I'm sure the Culinary Union said you got to say it. As I point out to people, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were against gay marriage in 2008. They weren't against gay marriage, but they had to say that, or at least they thought they had to say that. I'm not sure they even did. Or Hillary had to come out against the Trans-Pacific Pact in 2016, which he actually helped negotiate, which was one of the better ideas that the United States has come up with in a long time. And, of course, out of sheer stupidity, we made China stronger. But I'm not mad at the vice president for taking his policy position, but anyone that listens to this show just needs to know that is a horribly stupid idea. It won't go anywhere because as soon as they do the report on it, you see that. But you see this kind of cheap crap that's started by Donald Trump, who thinks he's a political genius for thinking it is. So we'll go from there.
Okay, now for our listener questions. James, Greg in Atlanta, Georgia, ask, how are Democratic prospects in Nevada and Montana Senate races? Are Florida and Texas just wishful thinking?
All right, so Democratic prospects, we're ahead in both, maybe semi-tied in Montana, all right? We're either tied or 1.5 up, which is tied. In Nevada, we're a little bit better than tied, but it's very stubborn in the presidential race. And, you know, of course, you got this tax on tips things, which everybody says is a big deal in Nevada. I'm showing it right. Yeah, look, and you asked me about Florida and Texas. Florida is just real, okay? I've seen too many public polls, too many private polls to say that we don't have a chance in Florida. That's insanity. And remember, you got the abortion referendum and you also have the marijuana referendum. So just to dismiss Florida, difficult, yes. Problematic, yes. Impossible, not even close to impossible. In Texas, you know, I think Harris helps a little bit. I think Collins is, you know, one of probably the best Senate candidate we've had, in maybe even including Beto. And Cruz is Cruz, okay? And he's not horrifically unpopular because of a Republican state, but he struggles to get to 50. I'm going to put a state in the mix. All right, let's key up the size and the bullshit and the Carville list. But tell you what could be in the mix. Nebraska. You heard it here first. Nebraska. All right. The incumbent is a senator named Deb Fischer, who has never been particularly popular in Nebraska. And there was there was an independent running who is pretty good. And the Democrats in Nebraska smartly decided that they were not going to run the Democratic candidate. So now you have Fisher, the Republican, and the independent. Who, remember, Angus King is an independent, all right? But he counts.
Right.
So I'm just, am I saying that we're going to win Nebraska? No, but I'm saying put it on your radar screen. It's a lot. And, you know, we got a couple of publics that don't know how good they are. I can assure you that there's going to be more than public polling here in the next week or 10 days. And I definitely think Florida is on the map. I think Florida's on the map for Harris, actually. I don't buy any of that. You know, we just didn't get anybody out. They had all the turnout in 2020. I don't think that's going to be the case in 2024, but I think they're in play, and I have Nebraska on my watch list.
Well, Greg, I'll tell you something else to put on your calendar, and that is October 12th, the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta, your hometown, because James and I are going to be down there. We're looking forward to meeting you then. Our next question is from Ben in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Ooh,
yeah. Historically famous place. Would it benefit the Harris campaign if Chris LaCivita and Susie Wiles were replaced in the Trump campaign? Ben, let me tell you, I don't know either one, really. Chris LaCivita, I'm sorry, I think he's a thug. He was involved in the Swift Boat smear campaign, and he's orchestrating the Walls smear campaign now. Susie Wiles gets great press. I'm sure she's very smart. But the people she's worked for, I just find a complete turnoff. It wouldn't make any difference if they're replaced. It's Donald Trump. I mean, these people say Trump ought to show more discipline. That's not who he is, and he's not going to change.
Well, all right, let's start. You wouldn't work for Trump unless you were a thug or there was something wrong with you. You wouldn't. An ordinary, patriotic person wouldn't get within 10 feet of Donald Trump. So we know automatically that both of these people have character flaws. He will probably bring something else in, but from every news report and everything that I see, he's furious at the whole thing. You know, of course, he took that press conference and made a bigger fool of himself. And what really gets to me, and you hear this all the time, You know, Trump doesn't understand. If he just, and we talked about this, if he just moderate, talked, he wouldn't say this crazy stuff. You don't understand. That's his appeal. Without the racism and the misogyny, he has nothing. And he knows that. And he's not going to listen to the campaign advisors that tell him to act sane or act normal or talk about pivoting to the middle or talk about talking about the issues, because that's not what the Republican Party is. That's not who votes in Republican primaries. That's not who's going to vote for them. And if they start taking the misogyny and the racism, not being a central part of the message, they'll lose even worse. These fucking people have no idea what they created. But I do.
Well.
Yeah. I guess I had an opinion on that, didn't I?
Tell us what you really think.
Yeah.
Next question is from Walt in British Columbia, Canada. Walt says, what issues could be used or how could messaging be tweaked to speak directly to male voters as a group and win some of them over?
It's a grand question. And let me tell you something. I was in Vancouver in early July. That might be one of my five favorite cities in the world. In terms of natural setting, it's top three in the world. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I think that I've always had this theory, and I think that Tim Walz might be giving me a little help, that our problem with male voters is that the whole thing is just way too feminine. It's what I call the NPR phenomena or messaging. And, you know, Walz has, is probably is more, quote, progressive, unquote, whatever the fuck that means, than maybe I am. I don't know. But what he does is stylistically, he was 24 years in the National Guard. He's a hunter. He speaks to people in regular language. He doesn't give you that haughty, you know, nasal coastal faculty lounge horse shit that we come across so many times for. And I think it's a lot of presentation. And I've got to give Vice President Harris credit. I think she recognized that this is a problem. And I said in the New York Times, much to the chagrin of many people and a lot of fainting and moaning and groaning and everything else, that Democratic campaign culture, it has, quote, too many preachy females, unquote. I stand by that remark. I knew what I was saying when I said it. I said it intentionally, and I meant it, and I still do.
Next is John, and this is, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Cuto, Ecuador, an Ecuadorian follower, James.
Right.
And he says, would Vice President J.D. Vance have the same power duties as previous vice presidents to certify the winner of the 2028 Electoral College vote, or did legislation curtail those powers? If J.D. Vance is the vice president in 2029, or January 6th, and the Republicans control the House, they don't care what the legislation said. They don't care. They really don't. I mean, the rule of law be damned. They're all about doing whatever it takes to keep their power. I don't think we're going to face that prospect. But, John, I wish I could give you a more encouraging answer.
So I talk a little bit about Cuto because I worked for way back. A guy named Joao Mohad, who was running for president. And his top aide was a woman named Ivana Baki, who's really extremely talented woman. I think Ivana could speak eight different languages. So Quito is a great city. I recommend it to anybody. And the climate is unbelievable because it's really high. So, and it's right on the equator. So there's a restaurant very close to Quito. And I don't know how to say it in Spanish, but it's called The Crater. There's a big crater. And you can stand. I have a picture of me with my left foot in the southern hemisphere and right foot in the northern hemisphere, because the equator goes right through there. It's a great country. Quito is, you know, I love that the climate in Bogota and Quito. Actually, Caracas is Venezuela's a godforsaken place. But if anybody's thinking about any vacation plans or doing something different, a kind of fun place, Mankato would be high on my list for sure.
Well, look up John when you're down there, too. And, John, we really appreciate
a lot of American expats there. There's tons of American expats in Quito.
James, next, Rob in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good question. Says the Republicans have openly embraced the alt-right and some neo-Nazis. And I'm curious, you know, isn't it incongruous that they also portray themselves as the most pro-Israel party?
Oh, well, how do I get started here? That is all background. Again, as I said earlier, it's really about the misogyny and the racism that drives the thing. We got to recognize that. It's not about any policy prescription. And the reason I suspect that most of these people describe themselves as pro-Israel because the Jews are whiter than the Palestinians, which I think drives a lot of what they are. And the other thing that I would comment politically on, and there's a huge Palestinian community right outside of Chicago. Obviously, Michigan is the sort of swing area. And my favorite comment to come out of this movement, these protests, which I think certainly if I were, I'm troubled by some of this stuff I see. I'll be honest with you, I'm not remotely Palestinian. But they asked him, why do you, Trump is even more radical or anti-Palestine or whatever you think that President Biden or Vice President Harris is, why don't you protest him? They said, because we wouldn't have any influence with him. So the reason that they say we targeted Democrats, because we think they would be more open-minded about this. But we're not going to do anything to the Republicans because they're not even, we're not going to have any influence. Well, that's just some dumbass political shit. All right? So are you going to hurt the person that actually has the best chance of resolving this issue in a satisfactory way because you can't influence the other person? I don't get the logic. I don't get the logic at all. I just don't.
Yeah. Well, I don't either. Brent in London. You know, we got a great international cast writing in this week, James. Brent says, does the Harris campaign need to do more to put a strong economic message at its center? You betcha. It really does. I think abortion is probably a great issue for them. Not probably, it is. It's an underrated issue. I think it turns out voters better even than it polls. And I think she obviously has to address some of the problems she had with immigration and other issues. But in the end, she has to convince people that she's better for your life than Donald Trump is. He's a danger. But I think they have a potentially strong message, a genuine populist message, as opposed to Trump. And I think that if she can convince people that she is at least as good and probably better on the economy than Donald Trump, that's a winning ticket.
So this is my view, because the economy is stupid, all right, and putting these issues kind of front and center. I think that people, you know, like Biden's number on the economy went up substantially when he dropped out. I think a lot of the stuff that people's negative economic views were is a relative held by the show. All right, the Financial Times, it's one poll, but it's Financial Times, not a bogus organization, now shows her ahead on the economy. But I think this is a better, maybe, response issue than attack issue. In other words, you're going to get questions about it. I think it's better addressed in responding to a question than just sitting there rattling off and trying to tell people how much better off you are under the Biden-Harris administration than you are under the Trump administration. And I believe that because there's still the economy operated as an economy for people over 50 and an economy for people under 50. And what happens right now, until there's more consensus that the economy is good, there should be more consensus. I think more consensus is coming that way. Sometimes to put it in front and center is the message to people that he doesn't see or she doesn't see what's going on in my life. So I agree, but I think it's a better responsive issue than it is forward issue.
Okay, our final question is from Bill in Daytona Beach, Florida, who wonders if it would work to build an ad asking, who would you want in the White House? The jolly couple who you'd enjoy having a beer with versus the angry uncle at Thanksgiving. I like the way you think, Bill.
Yeah. This is one of the things that, you know, Harris is talking about the joy of politics. Well, you know what? There's a lot of joy in politics. In my time in politics, I loved every day that I was in it. And there's no reason that we have to run around wearing a hair shirt all the time. I remember Hubert Humphrey, 1968, was talking about the joy of politics. By the way, he came a lot closer to winning than people realized in the midst of that horrific war. But, I think that's sort of an attractive part. And what's wrong with people having a little fun, huh? I have no idea. You know,
Peter Hart in the Wall Street Journal NBC poll, Peter Hart used to love to ask the question, who would you rather have a beer with, you know, X or Z? And he said most times, not all, people vote for the candidate that they think they like the most. There are exceptions. And the red states and blue states. But Bill, I think it's a good question. And if we didn't get to your questions this week, please send them in again, because I promise there are so many good ones, it's hard to pare them down, but we'll try to get to them next time.
I'm kind of reminded of our dear friend Mark Shields used to say. He said, politics is the most fun you're going to ever get your clothes on. I said, yeah, Mark, you get to take them off sometimes.
Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Remember to get your tickets for when James and I take Politics War Room to the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 19th and to the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta on October 12th. You can get your tickets at politicon.com/tour, and we can't wait to see you there. And tune into our Substack convention specials next week. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Beam, and ExpressVPN, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look, especially next week. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.